Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, the city America forgot, Rupert Murdoch is bored with Britain and is now interested only in the Wall Street Journal. That's according to one of his former editors, talking to a committee of the British Parliament. Andrew Neil edited Murdoch's Sunday Times in Britain for 11 years. He loved the Wall Street Journal. He'll love it even more now that he owns it, said Neil. Well, that's the best kind of love. He's bored with Britain now, said Neil. He's now got a new toy which totally obsesses him, the Wall Street Journal. He doesn't want to talk about anything else. Roop, get bored with America, too. Really? Thank you. Meanwhile, in news of supposedly other countries, the Canadian... Now, remember last week, the Canadian government listed the U.S. as a country that tortures? How did they get that idea? Now, we learn, the Canadian military secretly stopped transferring prisoners to Afghanistan's government 2 months ago, because Canadian monitors found evidence they were being abused and tortured. What? Are the Canadians like the torture police now or something? Really? This was disclosed in a fact sent by government lawyers to Amnesty and the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. The government's internal concerns about detainees is at odds with Canadian officials' repeated public statements that the Afghan government does not engage in torture. I'll tell you something. No, I won't. Ladies and gentlemen, the still Republican candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, Rudy Giuliani, had a lovely pair of statements this week in the Republican debate in Florida. In the first half hour, he said basically that the key to a successful to a healthy American economy is we have to make sure that we don't overtax, excuse me, I was lapsing into Giuliani's lisp, overtax, overregulate, or oversue. Half an hour later, discussing the complex global economy and the need to, in his mind, interact more proactively with other countries. We got to learn to sell them more stuff. He said that we have to engage with China to, among other things, make it a more business-friendly environment by encouraging the growth of the rule of law where you can sue, you see. So apparently, the only people Rudy Giuliani thinks it's okay to sue are the Chinese. Hello, welcome to the show.
closed my eyes, then I drifted to sleep. I dreamt about me maybe throwing a party, and just how great that would be. We had the best time at your party. The wife and I, thank you very much. We had the best time at your party. The wife and I, thank you very much.
From spitting distance within view of Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this very special, they're all very special, but this, really, swear to God, is a very special edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, as if to underline that, a very special edition of News from Outside the Bubble. How about this, from the BBC in London, recalling sort of a historical note, in the context of another story. Some observers recall what is referred to as a one-off meeting in local intelligence circles that took place in Afghanistan in the summer of 2001. Among those said to have been at the meeting in Kandahar were several Pakistanis, including a recently retired top nuclear weapons scientist. Also reportedly present was Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, who's said to have been intensely interested in how to acquire nuclear weapons. He'd heard that making the bomb was relatively simple, one witness later told officials. Obtaining weapons-grade uranium or plutonium was the problem, he was repeatedly told. At that point came a query that still worries Western security experts. Bin Laden is reported to have asked, "What if we already had the ore?" After 9/11, all the Pakistanis said to have attended the meeting were questioned by Pakistani and U.S. security agents. Some were released. Some remain in custody. Details of the investigation have never been made public. Just a nutty thing. Now, ladies and gentlemen, to the topic of bad apples. You remember that when we had our little Abu Ghraib thing, it was all blamed on bad apples. Nothing to see. Move along. Now comes a report from the British government. It's from The Guardian. Serious failings in army leadership, planning, and training, particularly about treating civilians in an occupied country, led to the abuse of Iraqis by British soldiers, according to an investigation by the Ministry of Defense. Who better to investigate the army than the soldiers were not told about their obligations under international law or about a specific ban on hooding imposed by the British government 36 years ago. You can't hood? Don't tell the Canadians. This is a report by Brigadier Robert Aitken, the Army's Director of Personnel Strategy. Troops were given scant information on how to treat civilian detainees and needed a better understanding between right and wrong. I thought Mom did that. Apparently now it's up to the Army. His report is a severe indictment of the overall failure to plan for the invasion and its aftermath. Oh, that again. It was ordered after a string of cases alleging ill treatment by British troops, notably the death of Baha Moussa, a hotel receptionist in Basra in September, 4 years ago, last September. He suffered 93 injuries while in British custody. Yeah, I guess those were wrong. I guess they were bewildered about whether that was right or wrong. 93 injuries. 8 other Iraqi civilians were abused. At a court-martial, the Ministry of Defense admitted the Iraqis were ill-treated. 1 soldier pleaded guilty. 6 others were acquitted of negligence and abuse. Bad apples. There will be a further inquiry to investigate what the Defense Secretary called these appalling incidents. The allegations against British soldiers center on 5 techniques: wall-standing, hooding, subjection to noise, sleep deprivation, and deprivation of food and drink. They don't know that's wrong. These are banned under international law. Well, okay, but so is waterboarding, so what's your point? Yet they're still not proscribed in the Army's military doctrine. In a telling passage directed at ministers of the government as much as military leaders, the report referred to the, quote, lack of awareness of the operational context by those responsible for preparing our people for the invasion. It pointed to the paucity of planning for nation building and uncertainty about the reaction of the Iraqis to invasion. Well, you know, in the future, maybe just assume that people don't like being invaded. You know, as a given. The Army failed to anticipate the differences between Iraq, the Balkans, and Northern Ireland, said the report. Soldiers were treated to deal with prisoners of war, but not with incidents of ordinary crime such as looting. Hey, stuff happens. The Times of London agrees that the report basically puts the blame on troops being ill-prepared and poorly trained, but that's not the responsibility of anybody at a higher level. You know, it's just bad apples. Bad apples growing off a confused tree. And also from the Times of London, President Karzai of Afghanistan accused his British allies of bungling the military operation in Helmand province and setting back prospects for the area by 18 months. He had little praise for the efforts of the almost 8,000 British troops deployed in his country. We suffered after the arrival of the British forces, he told a group of journalists at the Davos Economic Forum. Asked if he was blaming British failure for the return of the Taliban to the province, he said, I just described the situation of mistakes we made. The mistake was that we removed a local arrangement without having a replacement. We removed the police force. That was not good. Didn't that happen in the security forces were not in sufficient numbers or information about the province. Hey, didn't that happen in That is why the Taliban came in. This was not a failure, he said, but a mistake. By the way, in the same story, we learned that David Satterfield, the U.S. coordinator on Iraq, he told the Times of London this week that Iraq would turn out to be America's good war while Afghanistan was going bad. I'll run that. Remember, like a couple years ago, it was the reverse? David Satterfield, the U.S. coordinator on Iraq, of course, he's the coordinator in Iraq, not Afghanistan, he says Iraq would turn out to be America's good war. Afghanistan was going bad. Quote, in many ways, Iraq may be seen to be the success story, with all reservations and cautions that are appropriate, and Afghanistan the much more threatening bad picture, unquote. Wasn't Afghanistan the place where the people who... Wasn't that where Osama... He added, Afghanistan's problems went beyond differences with NATO and the lawlessness across the border in Pakistan. It is the nature of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has many deficits not present in Iraq. Afghanistan has warlords. Well, too late, smart, and... What is that? What is that stupid bumper sticker? Anyway, thanks to our special commissioner on Iraq. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast, and this is Le Show. And there's one more item of news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. On a lighter note, from The Guardian of London, all over Britain, more and more men, gay and straight alike, are marching into beauty salons and demanding a boyzillion, or as one Yorkshire-based salon puts it, the full Monty. In other words, the complete or near-complete removal of hair in intimate areas using wax. In wax! If you have $250 to spare, you can even get it done at Harrods, the famous British department store owned by the would-have-been father-in-law of Princess Diana. It's in Norwich. Now, Norwich is not London, ladies and gentlemen. Norwich has a dedicated waxing bar. It's between $90 and $120, depending on how hairy the client is, in Norwich. It's cheaper if men just want their bikini line done. That treatment is called the Speedo. Maybe these are the British troops that are in Helmand Province, you know? Spending too much time getting waxed? It just looks nice and tidy, said 44-year-old Father Stewart from near Ipswich after his treatment, which he described as, I'm quoting here, ladies and gentlemen, from a family newspaper, treatment he described as, quote, back, sack, and crack, unquote. Of course it is slightly painful, but in my experience, not nearly as sore as having your chest waxed. All right, you got me there, Stewart. It's much better than shaving it. He goes into detail. It's much better than shaving it, too. You don't get those awkward nicks, and it doesn't grow back anything like as quickly, said the beautician who worked on Stewart. Men seem better at dealing with the pain. They're always saying, oh, it doesn't hurt, but I suspect that might be male bravado. Women are never shy to scream the house down, unquote. As the beauty therapy industry is self-regulated, no one keeps figures of how many salons offer male intimate waxing. But Phil Swinford said it was a growing trend. Or overall, just 5% of beauty treatments are carried out on men, but as the whole market is increasing, so too are the number of men wanting treatments. 4 years ago, hardly any women were getting Brazilians. That apparently is the name of an intimate waxing treatment, and hence Boyzillions for the men. But now more and more salons are offering them. Kim Lawless, who calls herself the Wax Queen in London, specializes in intimate waxing for both sexes, but, quote, most of my clients are men. She adds that most of them were straight. They come from every walk of life and profession, accountants, stockbrokers, teachers, boxers, models. But, she adds, I've noticed that a lot of my clients are in the building trade. This would be why your contractor never gets anything done on time. He's off being waxed. A year ago, I was doing three men a week. I believe she means waxing them. Now I'm doing three men a day. I believe she means waxing them. I don't know why it has suddenly become more popular, but when people come in, they do mention David Beckham. You are familiar with him. The British soccer star who was, well, he spent last year making soccer America's national sport, didn't he? Back to Miss Lawless. Now that celebrities like him are open about waxing, I believe she means candid, it makes other men feel more comfortable about it. Is it really fashionable? An associate editor of GQ thinks it might be. There's a cleaner look that's really present in fashion today, and people pick that up in their subconscious. Men have been tidying themselves up for years, he says, but I can't see the majority going the full hog. It'll stay a vanity thing. So, they're not being trained well for the war. But their legs are cleaned right up. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
I'm thinking about a place. I'm waiting for a day when I can make my getaway. Because as any fool can see, there's nothing here for me but hurry up, boy, bring that water. Don't do things you shouldn't order. When I get away, find my easy street, I'll have a smile for all I meet. They will welcome me, I know. Everywhere I go, see the town and all its glitter. How could anyone be bitter? And there's a chance that I might find my big romance when I get to my city home. La 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 la. When I get away and find my easy street, I'll have a smile for all I meet, and they will welcome me, I know. Everywhere I go, no more thinking that I missed it. How could anyone resist him? And there's a chance that I might find my big romance when I get to my city. When I get to my city. When I get to my city.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there is a little bit more to this story from Britain about the bad apples. That's good apple country there. Colonel Jorge Mendonca. He's in the British Army, but he's a Jorge. He left the army after being charged but acquitted over that case of Baja Musa, the hotel receptionist who had 93 injuries before leaving the planet. He says, quote, the fact that there were failures in Iraq is a direct consequence of too few troops being deployed to an impossible situation without the correct support, resources, or plan, unquote. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, the British government and ours really were in lockstep on this whole thing. Did the same thing, the same way, the same time. That's what friends are for. The British newspaper The Guardian will challenge next week a gag order that prevents it from reporting on more allegations of abuse of Iraqis by British soldiers. So the British government is taking a similarly open-minded position regarding the press and the war and the thing. So we'll keep you on top of that, because I don't know, it doesn't seem to make the dog trainer. Of course, they're busy firing editors in Los Angeles, so it's hard for them to concentrate on the rest of the world. But now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to turn to a more statistical approach to the war. You may know about this story. I think it got a little oxygen this week before Barack and Hillary did their thing. A nonprofit group issued a report this week and a database documenting 935 false statements by President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and other top administration officials promoting the threat posed by Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the 2 years after 9/11. The Center for Public Integrity, I'm just clearing my throat here, don't worry about me, reports that its exhaustive examination of the record shows that the statements were part of an orchestrated campaign that effectively galvanized public opinion and in the process led the nation to war under decidedly false pretenses. That's their quote. The database documents how Bush and others had reason to know, or at least suspect, what they were saying was not supported by the facts. Charles Lewis and Mark Redding Smith write in the report's overview, quote, Bush and the top officials of his administration have so far largely avoided the harsh, sustained glare of formal scrutiny about their personal responsibility for the litany of repeated false statements in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Well, I thought the Democratic Congress was... There has been no congressional investigation, they continue, into what was exactly going on inside the Bush White House in that period. As a matter of fact, I'm quoting for a moment, the Senate Intelligence Committee was supposed to issue Phase 2 of their report on pre-war intelligence. Phase 2 was to cover how the administration might have misused, interpreted, reinterpreted, manipulated intelligence to promote the war in the run-up. Where's Phase 2? Senator Jay Rockefeller, the Democrat, who is now chairman of the committee, says, well, there's a lot of political rancor in the committee, so it's been tough to get to Phase 2. But he promises it's coming. Congressional oversight, ladies and gentlemen. Short of such review, says the report, this project provides a heretofore unavailable framework for examining how the war came to pass. They continue, President Bush and seven of his administration's top officials, including Vice President Cheney, National Security Advisor Rice, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, made at least 935 false statements in the 2 years following 9/11 about the national security threat posed by Saddam Hussein's Iraq. On at least 532 separate occasions, Bush and those three key officials, along with Secretary of State Powell, Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz, and White House Press Secretaries Ari Fleischer and Scott McClellan, stated unequivocally that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, links to al-Qaeda, or both. This President Bush made 232 false statements about WMDs and another 28 false statements about Iraq's links to al-Qaeda. The massive database at the heart of this project juxtaposes what President Bush and these seven top officials were saying in public against what was known or should have been known on a day-to-day basis. It interlaces relevant information from more than 25 government reports, books, articles, speeches, and interviews. The cumulative effect of these false statements, the report continues, amplified by thousands of news stories and broadcasts, hello NPR, was massive, with the media coverage creating an almost impenetrable din for several critical months in the run-up to the war. In August 2002, an address to the National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, which was spotlighted on this program for its repeated use of the words, no doubt, Cheney declared, simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us. He used no doubt several more times during that speech. In fact, former CIA Director George Tenet later recalled Cheney's assertions went well beyond the CIA's assessments at the time. Another CIA official referring to the same speech told journalist Ron Suskind, our reaction is, where is he getting this stuff from? The White House issued a dismissive statement in response to this report, saying basically, we've moved on. Why haven't they? But it's for those of us who were alive at the time, it's interesting and useful to have, as I say, ladies and gentlemen, kind of a statistical understanding of exactly what kind of storm we were being pelted with. So for the record, according at least to this report and searchable database. You know, that's the important part, because I just want to sit down and search that database for a while. Probably you do too, because you don't search enough databases in your working life. But just to know, as a matter of hard numerical fact, that what we were told were 935 lies.
Take three. rise to the skies. But somehow it ain't as scary as 935 lies. $1,000 will buy you a damn good suite at the Ritz. A truffle dinner, plenty champagne, a custom-made suit that fits. Yeah, $1,000 will buy you a pretty nice day in the store. But 935 lies will get you a $1 trillion war. 1,000 points of darkness pointing to a surprise. Guess what we were led to believe? 935 lies. 1,001 nights were magic, filled with amazing tales. Alibaba and Aladdin, Sinbad and his sails. But 935 fictions cut your hair as that down to size. Many more nights in Arabia, thanks to 935 lies. 935 falsehoods told by leading guys. Eyes of steel, tongues of fork, 935 lies. Pinocchio's nose kept growing, 'cause he refused to get wise. So a round of applause for the size of the schnoz that told 935 lies. Just one question asks me, what the hell was the prize? We know the wins and we know the who's. Somebody tell me the whys. Success has 1,000 fathers, the night has 1,000 dies. Failure's always an orphan with 935 lies. 935 falsehoods told by leading guys. Eyes of steel, tongues of fork, 935 lies. Couple hundred thousand Iraqis said their early goodbyes. It's the gift that keeps on giving. 935 lies. They told us 935 lies. 935 lies. 935 lies. And I'm counting 935 lies.
This is Le Show.
Sede de amor, febre de anseio. Quase a escuridão. Você partiu, me reduziu, amor. Me perco em lágrimas. Não mais a vi desde abril. Fui pro mar e você lá deitada na pedra. Que inveja dessa pedra. Acabe um lance novo e despertou. Desde já só quero estar com quem me serve. E de resto serei breve. Nada fica em pé pra quem se quebra numa paixão. Só um louco absurdo. Não mais me vejo assim. Tô a pé, mas chego onde vou. Revela, só foi ruim, porque nada me causou. Doeu, me ressenti, quando você me desprezou. Mas hoje estou aqui, algo como a flor na pedra, presta a nascer. Sede de amor, febre de anseio.
nada fica em pé pra quem se quebra numa paixão. O mundo é vão e tudo é só um pouco absurdo. Não mais me vejo assim, tô a pé, mas chego onde vou. Revela, só foi ruim, porque nada me causou. Eu me ressenti quando você me desprezou. Mas hoje estou aqui, algo como uma flor na pedra presta.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First, from John Gibson of Fox News.
I have received emails regarding some comments I made on this radio show the other night. After the shocking death of Heath Ledger, I'm sorry that some gay groups and others took my comments as anti-gay and insensitive. I'm aware that Ledger has a family and many fans who were grief-stricken by his sudden death. As we speak here now, a crowd is gathering at the funeral home where Ledger services will be held here in New York City. Those who knew him say he was a good actor and a loving dad to two-year-old Matilda. And what happened to him was terrible, but it was evidently an accident. Once again, to anyone offended by my comments, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry that Heath Ledger is no longer alive and with us.
No, more groveling, please. Dateline Korea President No Moo-yeon this week apologized for the massacres of hundreds of leftists in this country during the Korean War. Quote, I deeply apologize on behalf of the country for the misconduct of the government in the past. I also express my consolation to the victims and families, he said. Not quite Gibsonian, but pretty good. Dateline Los Angeles, a humor editor who published books of jokes by Jay Leno and other comedians without their permission, has apologized and agreed to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages. Judy Brown and her publishers have settled the copyright infringement lawsuit filed on behalf of NBC. Yeah, NBC writes a lot of jokes. Leno, Rita Rudner, Jimmy Brogan, Diane Nichols, Sue Pasco, Kathleen Madigan, and Bob Ettinger, I believe those would be among Jay's writers. I thought it was important to make it clear that jokes are protected like any other art form, Leno said in a statement. He's right. It's okay to write a statement while the strike is going on? I guess so. Brown apologized. The best comedians may make comedy seem easy, but I know it takes talent, hard work, and careful preparation to make people laugh. She said, that is why I'm settling this lawsuit by agreeing never again to publish their jokes without asking their permission to do so. Everybody knows this one already. A goth who leads his girlfriend around with a dog leash and collar was stopped from getting on a bus in England amid fears for passenger safety in Yorkshire. The black-clad couple said they'd been told to leave one bus and prevented from boarding another. The company said it was writing to the goth to apologize for any distress caused by the way this matter was handled. You've got to be careful about goth sensitivities, ladies and gentlemen. The Zeta Psi Pledge at Yale, who was shown holding a derogatory sign in front of the Yale Women's Center in a photograph that surfaced last weekend, has spoken publicly for the first time and says he did not even read the sign before he held it up. Giovanni Christodoulou said the Zeta Pledges were participating in a scavenger hunt when they posed in front of the Women's Center with a sign that read, quote, "We love Yale sluts," unquote. "I never even read the sign," said Christodoulou, a wide receiver and defensive back for the Yale football team. Follow-up question, can he read? Not asked. They gave me the sign and I held it up. The photograph of the 12 pledges was posted on Facebook and quickly made the rounds. Zeta President Jonathan Charest apologized to the Women's Center for the photograph, published in the Yale Daily News. But he and other members of the fraternity have declined requests to be interviewed or quoted by name regarding the incident. In a television interview, however, Christodoulou apologized for the photograph. "I never disrespect women. That was very uncharacteristic of myself," he said. "We're all terribly sorry, and we learned our lesson." Now, it's a learning experience going to Yale, isn't it? It was for George W. What? George W. Who? And finally, ladies and gentlemen, Dateline Chicago, a sex advice columnist resigned from the New York Press. Why would that be? Oh, I see, because it comes from editor and publisher, which is in Chicago. After the Alternative Weekly discovered that questions for her inaugural sex advice column, Lip Service, well, she worked hard on the name, were plagiarized from past columns by another columnist, syndicated advice columnist Dan Savage. Wonder if his real name is Wiener, like Mike Savage's. In a note to readers in its current issue, the New York City paper said columnist Claudia Lanau, whom it identified as, quote, "a television writer based in Los Angeles who had not previously written for a newspaper," unquote. Well, there's a strike on. What do you want? Plagiarized the questions for the first column because she had no reader questions. "It had been our understanding," said the paper, "that the questions for her first column came from her friends. She has told us she was unaware that using questions from Savage's column was a breach of journalistic ethics. We apologize to her readers and to Dan Savage for this error in judgment." She didn't have any questions from readers because she didn't have any readers, you see. That's how it goes, ladies and gentlemen. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now another copyrighted feature of the show. It's called News of the Warm, won't you? I was in a club where they smoked cigarettes last night. That's the where the phlegm is coming from. In case you're wondering.
Listen to the warm.
I know I was wondering. The world's climate
the
is clearly out of balance and is warming. That's according to the world's largest society of Earth and space scientists. So, skeptics now aim your darts at the American Geophysical Union, warning that changes to the Earth's climate system were, quote, not natural. Well, neither are the noses of most people in Beverly Hills. Changes in temperature, sea level, and rainfall were best explained by the increased concentration of greenhouse gases from human activities, it added. The union called for carbon emissions to be cut by more than 50% by 2100. That's the first time the American Geophysical Union has updated its policy position on climate change. In 5 years, it called for a concerted worldwide study in 2003. The revised statement goes further, stating the changes to the planet's climate system were, quote, best explained by the increased atmospheric abundances of greenhouse gases and aerosols generated by human activities in the 20th century. The American Geophysical Union Council, which adopted the updated position, said a sustained research effort involving many of its members had strengthened the scientific understanding of the impact of climate change. It warned the world faced a tough challenge over the coming 50 years. Even the lower limit of impending climate change is far beyond the range of climate variability experienced in the past 1,000 years, it said. Of course, 1,000 years in Earth's geologic time is a blink, but we'll let that pass. Dateline Miami, rising ocean temperatures linked to global warming could, and here's the switcheroo, could decrease the number of hurricanes hitting the United States. That's according to new research released this past week. Whew! We're going to breathe easy here in New Orleans. We'll have a non-hurricane party. The study was published in Geophysical Research Letters and challenges Recent research that suggested global warming would contribute to an increase in the frequency and intensity of Atlantic hurricanes. But at the same time, the new research reaffirmed earlier views that warmer sea waters might result in atmospheric instabilities that could prevent tropical storms from forming.
Huh?
Atlantic storms play a pivotal role in the global energy, insurance, and commodities markets. The new study suggests that warmer seas caused by greenhouse gases, blamed for a rise in global temperatures, are linked to an increase in vertical wind shear, a difference in wind speeds at different altitudes that can tear apart nascent hurricanes.
Oh.
News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This week, the head of NBC, Jeff Zucker, announced, or was reported to have announced in the New York Times, that his network is scrapping, or at least seriously considering scrapping, the system of television pilots, that is to say, sample episodes of a new series which a network will commission, and they'll commission as many as 70 of them. Then they actually order maybe 5 or 10, and of those, none become hits. And some people say that system doesn't make any sense. One of them is Jeffrey Zucker. So he says they're not going to do pilots anymore. They'll use their gut more, network executives, and make their decisions based on scripts alone, because they are such great script readers, ladies and gentlemen. Take it from Jeffrey Zucker. Meanwhile, in trying to examine the post-strike landscape, programming executive of NBC, Ben Silverman, has promised more shows based on existing formats. Damn it! Somebody has finally gotten the message. That's what we want. More shows based on existing formats. Of course, the question of what's going to happen when networks aren't making pilots anymore is one that deserves more thoughtful consideration, don't you think?
Fasten your seatbelts, because the pilots are going away. Plus, the newest reality series doesn't employ writers. It's about writers.
Got to be a strike edition of Inside Extra Access tonight for the end of January 2008.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo, 6 months sober. NBC's announcement this week that it may abandon making pilots for new television series sent a shudder of fear through many parts of the TV business and a thrill of excitement through at least one other. Jeremy Schamberg has been planning a new cable channel for the last 3 years, and now may be his big break.
The pilot channel is sort of the yin to TV land's yang. You know, they're about old TV shows that you've seen a million times. We're about shows you've never seen and never will. Some of them you laugh at. Some of them make you laugh at the executives who didn't buy them. Some of them might even not make you laugh at all.
Part of NBC's explanation for pulling the plug on pilots is how expensive they become to produce. But what the networks see as a flaw, Jeremy sees as a feature.
Yeah, they've got production values much higher than a normal series episode, so the pilot channel is... it's a lot like a movie channel, except after seeing one of our shows, you get the fun of imagining what the eventual series from that pilot might have been like. That's why we like to say that we're the network that lives in your head.
A lot of the pilot channel offerings will be pilots made by the big networks in the glory days gone by. But Jeremy Schamberg says there'll be original pilots, too.
We picked up a pilot that ABC never made called She's Your Daddy, about a female same-sex couple raising a precocious, wisecracking kid. One of the moms is sassy. The other one plays it by the book. I think that character was originally part of a cop series. On the drama side, we've got a very edgy piece that NBC commissioned. The script is paid for. Half the thing is already shot. It's about a team of trial lawyers assigned to help build the legal system in Iraq by going over there to practice American-style law. The working title was Baghdad Legal, but, you know, we're cable. We can be more edgy. We're thinking of changing it to Sue Your Face Off. We're very high on it.
Several cable systems say they're taking another look at the Pilot Channel. And Jeremy's stoking the fire of interest with a billboard campaign all over Hollywood, featuring models dressed as flight attendants. The message in big red letters, Pilots Take Me Higher.
Thank God when television began, the networks thought up the name Pilots for these things. That's worth several million dollars in marketing leverage to us and to whoever buys us.
The Pilot Channel could be on your cable box before the fall. Or not.
During the writers' strike, the TV networks have struck gold with more reality shows. And this week, the Writers Guild gave up its demand to organize the writers who work on those unscripted shows. Now, in a new twist, veteran TV writer-producer Jordan Jourdain has sold a new reality series, So You Wanna Be a Writer.
Everybody thinks they can write a script. You know, half the people in this town are driving around with a script in the back seat of their Corolla or whatever. This is a show that lets them compete for the right to get a staff job on this very show.
In this exclusive preview scene from one upcoming episode of So You Want to Be a Writer, three contestants, Cassidy, Vince, and LaToya, try to pitch storylines in a writing room being lowered into a Columbia River Rapids.
What if the guy is like a really studly bartender who's trying to get into the pants of like this really a hot woman who's, you know, like a, I don't know.
Anchoring the local news?
No, something cooler.
Training to be an astronaut?
Oh, get a little more 20th century, would you?
Hey, I don't think your attitude is going to help us once we're bouncing around in the rapids.
Amen.
You know, one of the questions we got early on in the development phase was, what's cool about watching writers? So our answer was to get really hot-looking contestants and put them in water a lot. We also have a regular competition called the Commissary, where the first contestant to finish eating a raw worm burger gets to go home before the table read.
So You Want to Be a Writer premieres on CBS shortly later.
That's it for today, but Inside Extra Access tonight comes rolling back tomorrow with the results of our latest IEAT poll.
We asked which young actor you'd most hate to see accidentally die, and the results will have you calling 911.
Till then, I'm Pat Mungo.
And I'm Mike DeVere.
So long from Culver City.
This is the show. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the broadcast. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, around the world via the internet at two different locations. Whenever you want it, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, on XM and Sirius satellite radios. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Though some people said last week's podcast had static on it. That wasn't a flaw, that was a feature. And it'd be just like finding all those bad apples. You keep screwing up our wars if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. AriShearer.com is the place to find the email address for this broadcast, as well as the playlist of the music featured here on. A tip of the show chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO FM in New Orleans for making today's broadcast a broadcast. Next week, you'll have to peel the beads off me. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Home, I said, of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.